This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
Tell someone in your life, tell 10 people in your life about what happened to the Prairie Land Defendants and make sure that they understand this could have been any of us. It's all of us. Anyone who's doing anything to resist this administration, to push back against the way that ICE is terrorizing our communities.
The Prairie Land Nine were arrested after a noise demonstration outside an ICE detention facility last July. On March 13th, they were convicted of multiple criminal offenses in a Dallas-Fort Worth federal court.
Universal health care should be the number one issue for every labor union, every worker, because without it, we don't have freedom to move job to job, to move city to city. We are stuck and they keep us stuck.
Throughout California, teachers strike for living wages and health care. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. The Prairie Land Nine are a group of nine North Texas friends and activists who were arrested last year after a July 4th noise demonstration outside an ICE detention facility in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. They were charged with multiple criminal counts, including attempted murder, conspiracy, riot, and giving material support to terrorists. Some were held for months in solitary confinement, and all face multi-million-dollar bail demands. Their show trial concluded on March 13, when all nine were convicted of at least one count. They remain in custody, awaiting sentencing in June. Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke spoke to Amber Lowry, sister of one of the defendants, about the trial, its unusual procedures, and what it could mean for other political dissidents.
This is Thomas O'Rourke for Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, Pacifica Radio. I'm speaking to Amber Lowry, who is a relative of one of the Prairie Land Nine defendants, a group of anti-ICE protesters who were recently convicted in a federal court in Fort Worth, Texas, back on
March 13th.
Amber, please introduce yourself to our Pacifica Radio audience and explain as much as you can publicly the extent of your involvement in this trial.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having us on, Thomas. We appreciate it. My name is Amber Lowry. My sister, Savannah Batten, is one of the convicted Prairie Land defendants. My involvement with the noise demonstration that night was nothing, although it could have been. You know, I could have been any one of the thousands of people who might have come across that flyer for that noise demonstration and gone that night, and I would be in jail right now. What actually happened is, you know, like I say, you have a group, not even a group, they weren't a group before, several friend groups picked up this flyer out of one of the many, you know, local signal chats, inviting folks out for a noise demonstration, you know, come on out, make some noise. Some of the folks decided to put on a fireworks display for the Prairie Land detainees being held inside. People had noisemakers, maracas, bullhorns, things like that.
Let me clarify, Amber, you were not present that night?
I was not present that night.
Okay.
No.
Describe the circumstances surrounding the original incident last July 4th outside the ICE Prairie Land facility.
Yes. So you had a handful of protesters who ran across this flyer in a random signal chat saying, you know, we're going to basically have this noise demonstration in observation of the July 4th holiday. We're going to go out and make some noise to support the detainees being held inside Prairie Land ICE Detention Center in Alvarado, Texas. That was the extent of the planning, you know, of this noise demonstration. Come out, you know, a couple of the protesters had decided to actually do a fireworks display around back of the building where there's basically the full wall is glass. And so the detainees were able to actually watch the fireworks display as it was happening. People brought bullhorns, maracas, just make some noise so the people inside know that, we're out here, we know about you, we're working, diligently to get you guys free.
I assume fireworks, like many guns, are legal in Texas, and
Absolutely.
it's okay to set them off no matter where you are, I guess.
There are certain rules about it, but I can tell you, I live in a suburb, a suburb of Fort Worth, and I can't get the police. We've had neighbors here, literally one or two houses away. We can't get the police out when someone's roof is on fire on the 4th of July. So that in that way, also the police did mention that they were inundated that night. The local police, Alvarado, there were inundated with fireworks calls that night. But to our knowledge, these would be the only ones who were arrested for it.
How were the defendants rounded up, and how did they get to the point where they were charging people with attempted murder and material support to terrorism?
Those are all great questions. A lot of what actually happened during that night has been unknown to most of us because, you can't speak freely on the jail phone, so there hasn't been a lot of conversation about what actually happened. But, everyone let us know early on what they're saying is not true. This is not this, and I don't know the other defendants, but I know my sister like I know myself, and so I know I can I know that I can believe her when she tells me this is not what happened. I know most in detail my sister's arrest, which occurred with four other individuals because they were the ones who had direct contact with Officer Reedy, who is a warden at Prairieland ICE Detention Center. So they had direct contact with him. He had expressed that someone from outside had called inside and said, "Hey, there's fireworks going on out here. There's, whatever that we need to just investigate this commotion." And so Officer Reedy, and I believe an Officer Hart, would have been the first to exit Prairieland Detention Center, and they go out and they actually have contact with a handful of the protesters, one of which I later learn was apparently my sister, who was that night never touched a firearm, never had or touched a firework, didn't break, didn't paint, didn't damage anything. Just so you understand, this is true for a lot of these people. Committed zero crimes that night. So these five people are approached by Officer Reedy, and again, I believe it was Officer Hart. And told you're on government property, you need to leave. And so it sounds like several of them had started to clean up the mess from the fireworks display, and they were, going. And so that was kind of the delay in them being there and then taking off was just a couple of minutes because they cared enough to clean up their mess. So
Were
they are doing.
they instructed to clean up the debris?
No, I don't. That didn't come up in trial. We know that they did clean up because several officer witnesses had mentioned such. We know that they did clean up that firework trash, but that they, as soon as Officer Reedy told them that they had to leave, they did. And so that cluster of five, actually, they were sent down Tanglewood, which is just the road right off there where I guess the cars were parked. So they were sent that way and told to get off the property. So they're walking back, and they're, it came up so many times during officer testimony that they were just walking. They were, first of all, they were not wearing what the government said they were wearing. My sister was wearing blue jeans and a skimpy little tank top and like white sneakers. There was another girl wearing pink and white sneakers. There was a male wearing gray or silver shorts. So this whole idea that they were all head to toe black block, tactical, yada yada, was not accurate, was not true. In fact, we heard the government, all of these cops who were testifying, they all one by one said, "Oh yeah, black block tactical." Every single one of them couldn't tell who was male or female, couldn't tell a single thing as they walked by because they were all in black block. And then we see the video of them walking by, and not one of these people is in black block,
The
as has been
video filmed
described.
by the cops themselves, right?
Officer Warren
Yes.
body cameras, video evidence that these
Yeah.
people walked by wearing blue jeans and random colored t-shirts and tank tops, and one even had on a bright blue basketball jersey. And so I have to ask myself, is that one of the things that some of our jurors slept through? How
Yeah.
did this not come out? So all of these things came out.
Well, let me ask you from here, Amber, describe the judge's behavior and decisions. This is a federal judge named Mark Pittman, apparently a Trump appointee. I'm not sure when. Was it in this term or Trump's first term? Not that
I
it makes
think
much
first
difference.
term.
Oh, okay. So
Yeah, it
he's
would have
been
been
on
the
the
first
bench
term.
for 4 or 5 years at least. So what describe his behavior and decisions during the jury selection and the trial itself. He apparently declared a mistrial without a request from either side. Is that true? And did a new jury make the difference in the verdicts, do you think?
Absolutely. So I do have to be careful. I've been warned by no fewer than 100 people that if I say anything that insults or offends the powers that be, that it will be taken out on our defendants. So I'm going to be pretty careful about how I put this. But I would say that it's well documented that there was a lot of irregularity in the behavior and decisions made. As you are aware, yes, we didn't in the first trial, which was slated to start February 17th, we didn't get past voir dire because the official reason that it was put in the press and that everyone has heard is that it was because the defense attorney was wearing a shirt in honor of Jesse Jackson, who had passed away that morning. But I will say that we knew a couple of hours before that things were very uncomfortable during questioning of the jury. There were, things came up like Judge Pittman specifically had asked one of the jurors, can you commit to following the law in this court as I give it to you? And she was very careful to say, I follow the law according to the Constitution. So without knowing what you would instruct me to do, I can't give a blanket guarantee that, yes, I'll do what you say. I would need to know what you're going to instruct me to do, and is it constitutional? And he tells her, I know you might think you know more about the law than anybody here, but in this courtroom, I need to know that you can follow the law as I give it to you. And she said, I guess I can't because I don't know what you would ask me. And he said, I never got that answer before. So there was a lot of like that kind of there were a lot of jurors who expressed disapproval of, what immigration control and enforcement is doing, as well as the Trump administration broadly. I believe that things, I would say,
Were they peremptorily challenged by the state, these jurors, or did the judge rule them ineligible?
this first jury that I haven't even spoken about the second jury pool yet, but this first jury, the attorneys were asking questions as would normally happen during voir dire. It wasn't until the second jury pool that the judge took over and selected his own jury.
Yes, he actually
So
selected the jury.
he did
He interviewed
single-handedly.
jurors in front of both sides, and then he chose his selections.
Yes. And
Well,
also between that time of declaring the mistrial, and again, I will say that the mistrial was going to happen before the shirt came up, but it was the questions about, people's bias against ICE and the Trump administration and police in general. Those kinds of questions had created an environment where I feel like we were already looking for a reason for a mistrial at that point. And yes, when it came up that this attorney was wearing a shirt that the judge didn't like, it was, I cannot overstate how dramatic this turn of events was, given that no one had noticed the shirt all day. No one had said a word about the shirt all day. I couldn't see it. We were watching on screen because at that time the public was being kept out of the courtroom. So no one saw the shirt. I mean, literally no one saw the shirt. But after reading,
The lawyer was wearing a jacket over the shirt,
yes, she was
and
wearing just a
so the
suit
judge must have
jacket.
been someone tattled on the lawyer or to the judge, huh?
I suppose that's very likely. So much of it is a show. It could have just been an act, but even the prosecution did not appear to want a mistrial at that point. But I do think that everyone was feeling a little unsteady, just given how many of that jury pool expressed their true feelings about what ICE is doing and the Trump administration. And so I think that's where it started. And then the jury came neutral on the topic of whether or not one can carry a gun at a protest. And I think that the response to that was underwhelming for them. So all of those things combined to create a situation where, and I will also say, Pittman said on February 17th, as he was declaring this mistrial, remarked to the prosecution something along the lines of, "This is going to get, if I don't do this, it's going to get reversed at the Fifth Circuit." So he had already decided how this trial was going to go by that time. So.
Well, let's hope it's all reversed at the Fifth Circuit. Next question, Amber. How was the political smear of Antifa used by the prosecution throughout the trial as though it is an actual organization? This echoes, of course, the common thread among contemporary right-wing circles and the Trump administration's law enforcement apparatus. And of course, Trump, bloviates about it all the time. Though to keep things in perspective, it seems to me that many of these charges were based on the brief or briefcase or hard drive of federal laws that were targeted terrorism, beefed up after the September 11, 2001 attacks by a Patriot Act and all these supporting laws and policies. In other words, it's been a generational assault on free speech and political speech. So, how did the defense attempt to combat these and other smears thrown at them, both in the court and in the media?
I would say that they used a tactic that we heard about from Steve Bannon a handful of years ago that they call, if I can, if can I say curse words on here? They call it flooding the zone with shit, just
Okay.
to confuse. That's the best description that I could give of what they did, because what ended up becoming clear by the end of the trial is that, the NSPM7 memo was filled with Antifa, Antifa, Antifa. This trial was filled with Antifa, Antifa, Antifa. Even though by the end of it, we learned that in fact, only the one cooperating defendant who we suspect of being a government plant at this point, he's the only one who pointed the finger at anyone and said, "Oh, yeah, that person's Antifa." All of the other cooperating defendants signed documents saying, "Yes, these other people are Antifa," but when they were actually pressed about it on the stand, not one of them said that anyone had ever claimed to be Antifa. They used photographs of pamphlets pulled off of the internet, pulled off of people's phones. They used printed zines and these things. Let me tell you how confused the jury was. The morning of March 12th, Thursday, March 12th, this would be the first day of jury deliberations. We were called back for jury questions, and one of the questions that they had was, they wanted to be provided with a copy of the Emma Goldman Book Club Antifa Handbook, which is a thing that does not exist.
Yes.
There is an Antifa Handbook, a very famous Antifa Handbook that has nothing to do with the Emma Goldman Book Club, but that is how they cobbled this insane case together, just by confusing these people with thousands of pictures of stickers and zines and reading lists from a literal book club. They lied to the jury and told them that when Marisela had mentioned on the phone someone needing to take care of her dogs, cats, and bunnies, "Please reach out to the community and let everyone know what has happened. Reach out to our community." They on the stand, they said the word community infers something nefarious, some sort of conspiracy or criminal activity. The word community. So they use things like this, all stitched together with the right's wildest Antifa fantasies. And most of it was not even anything to do with the case. They didn't have to prove Antifa for, in order to prejudice this jury against these people who
No doubt.
are a member of no such organization. Literally, a couple of these protesters were members at one point of the Socialist Rifle Association. My sister was at one of them, so I don't have a direct, line to that organization to speak on any of their activities. But yeah, a
Did
couple
they
of
bring
them.
their membership cards or just a recent Target practice result? I mean, how do you prove your Jesus? So, safe to say, the Antifa was addressed and apparently the judge allowed so often it to go unchallenged that it really did make its way into the mindset of the jury. Is that your fair
Yes, and
assessment?
absolutely. And they had, I'll tell you, so many irregularities took place throughout this whole trial, but I will say it got, as tragic as this is, it got quite comical when they brought in who I have come to know as Antifa Kyle Scheidler, in this self-professed Antifa expert. And he really didn't have to prove anything. He got up on the stand. He's the only expert witness who was not, or excuse me, he's the only witness of theirs who was not ever made to leave the room while others were testifying. Apparently, there's some sort of a rule about this. He was around the whole time. He was in contact with another self-professed Antifa expert, Andy Ngo, and he was telling absolute blatant lies to Andy Ngo, who was also live tweeting through the trial, just different accusations of, the family members are intimidating the jury, they're threatening the judge, people are, all of these insane things that were not happening. It's like the federal government, all of the trolls at the top, the people that are running the social media accounts, all of their little influencers, they played such an active part of this trial. And even up to the 2 days of jury deliberations, the prosecution, as they would be bringing in their cartloads of evidence, Antifa Kyle was with the evidence the entire time. He was with the government the entire time, had access to full discovery. My mom and I stepped onto an
But
elevator.
he was deemed an expert witness. First off, repeat his name and what in court did he say was his qualifications to be, and
Oh.
how did the fact he had been present throughout the trial, how did defendant attorneys react to this?
So his name is Kyle Scheidler. The government tells us that this gentleman is an Antifa expert. During his testimony, we learned that everything that he professes to know about Antifa has been gleaned from open source, books, pamphlets. I suppose he's reading all of the same zines that he used to convict these nonviolent protesters of being terrorists, probably reading a lot of the.
Had he published anything that could be cited as
No, absolutely not. He has n
expertise? I
nothing, no,
see.
absolutely no
So
peer-reviewed.
self-professed.
He is a self-made Antifa expert.
And government paid witness, right?
Absolutely, yes.
So how was it he was able to.
He actually, we learned during his testimony, he misspoke, and then he went back and said, "Oh no, I didn't write it." But we learned that his definition of Antifa is what was used in all of the charging documents and in all of the factual resumes, and he helped draft all of the documents that were used to charge, and that all of that expertise came from him.
How did the cop who was apparently hit by a bullet, I read one account that it was probably a ricochet, but how did he act during the incident, and why were his actions not used against the state's case, and how was his story challenged? Because apparently he drew his gun, and then he received a bullet. Is that about right?
Yeah, so what we ended up learning, again, through officer testimony and body camera video that was shown in court, is that of course, there were two cops, and I felt like this looked really overacted. There was some body camera video of officers either by the red van or sort of standing off on their own, not really knowing what was going on. They found one gun case in the back of a red minivan that was apparently driven by Megan Morris. And the officers were very, you heard a lot of guys saying, shouting expletives and saying, "Oh my God, there's one gun case back there," and they're saying, "Oh, this is obviously a terror attack on Prairie Land." It was just very weird. The officer who was alleged to have been shot, yes, we did.
You're alleging they were performing for their own cameras. Is that safe to guess?
I'll just say I will be fighting to have all of this video released because people need to see it.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So the officer who was alleged to have been shot, we ended up learning that yes, he had arrived at Prairie Land, and this is after it was highlighted that multiple protesters had had pleasant, respectful, nonviolent interactions with the wardens at Prairie Land. These unarmed wardens had come out and were, looking at speaking face to face with protesters. They were all very clear that no one, in spite of rumors that had been started by the person who called 911, no one tried to breach either of the gates. No one tried to enter the gates. No one attempted to get into the facility, nor, I mean, they could, anyone who wanted to could have gone over any of the fences, but the fact is that they did not. This was set up and spun as a big attack, and that they tried to get inside. And I think the government even tried to hint at one point that there had been a plan to go in and just break all of the detainees out of Prairie Land. I mean, over 1,000 people, right? So the officer who was alleged to have been shot, he within three.
They were watching too many Academy Award-winning movies, apparently.
I had fun watching. I
Fever
had to
dreams
watch that last
surrounding
night.
one planet after another, one battle after another,
Battle
excuse
after
me,
another.
are getting hysterical, I think. I
Okay.
mean, the opening scene is a set piece with fireworks and r releasing migrants jailed under a freeway and all that. It was, sort of an opening. Yes, to resist, opening tour de force, I should say, but.
Yes.
This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Polina Vasiliev. Here's more from Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke speaking to Amber Lowry about the Prairie Land 9 show trial.
Did the defendant lawyers call any witnesses or have the defendants testify? And if not, why not, do you think?
Well, we had witnesses and expert witnesses that had been hired to educate people on things like Antifa and what the Emma Goldman Book Club actually was, rather than what the government tried to paint it out to be. We had these witnesses lined up. They were present. They were ready to testify. I don't know what happened Wednesday night. We knew that the prosecution was wrapping up that evening, and assumed that we were gearing up to have our side. And suddenly, without any warning to anyone, I understand that a few of the defendants were notified ahead of time, but no family member, nobody else in the court knew that the defense was going to rest without even mounting an affirmative defense.
How have the lawyers explained themselves?
It's a I've talked to other lawyers who don't even have anything to do with this case, and several have said, this is a valid tactic. It's a strategy. I don't know. I don't know how I feel about it as a strategy, but it is apparently a strategy. And I don't presume to know the first thing about lawyering. So I the families, we are confused, we're upset. We haven't really had the opportunity to have these conversations in depth like we will, because there's a lot of urgent things that have to be filed this week to preserve, all of
Okay.
the defendants' rights to appeal and to file for a new trial and things like that. So I expect we'll get more answers about that and what the idea was behind it. But I honestly believe that I think the attorneys perhaps overshot their coverage on the engagement and the critical thinking abilities of perhaps the average Texan.
They
And they thought,
assume too much. Yeah.
yeah, that's what I
Yeah.
think. I think that, we all watched the drama play out. And, when we learned that the government lied about the Black Bloc, and when we learned that they lied about the shooting, and that, all of these different things, we thought, surely the jury is seeing this, but
Well, I
they
just
didn't.
wonder, were the defendants themselves prepared to testify on their own behalf? Was your
A
sister,
couple of
for
them
example,
were.
expecting to testify on her own behalf?
I don't think that Savannah was scheduled to testify. I mean, there really just wasn't anything for her to say. She was the one, and I don't say this to set her apart from other protesters or what have you. I say this just to make sure that people understand the absurdity of it all, is that, they couldn't directly charge her with anything gun related, anything firework related, with vandalism, anything, because she did nothing. So they charged and convicted her of all of it under, these general broad, riot and conspiring to move explosives. Well, she never had an explosive, touched an explosive, used an explosive, explosives, right? I knew we were in trouble when Assistant U.S. Attorney Sean Smith walked in the very first morning during voir dire and asked the jury, anybody out here shoot fireworks? Most people said yes. He said, okay, are we, is everybody, does anybody have any, he said, I'd like for the purposes of this trial to designate fireworks as explosives. Does anyone have a problem with that designation? We should have seen that there for what it was more. And I do remember just like feeling a tingle go down my spine when he said that. And, because it's like, sure, as long as I can call this egg a potato, then we can talk about these things as if there's something else other than what they were,
Yeah.
which
It
was a
seems
theme
like,
throughout the trial.
literally going into the minutiae of how much gunpowder was in a particular M80 or bottle rocket or something might be, but I'm not sure there's what will be, as far as you know, the grounds for appeal, and what other trials are pending in state courts. That's what the media says. There's still sort of initial trials for some people. But clearly, the grounds for appeal are being, are being debated and thought through. What do you think of those?
Well, my understanding is that we've got, well, there are many grounds for appeal. There's some things that are still, yet unknown. We even all the way back to when the defendants were just moved to Tarrant County to prepare for trial, things happened in the jails that significantly worsened their quality of life. I mean, they had a really bad time. They'd be woken up in the wee hours of the morning and asked, do you want to take your rec time right now? It's 3 in the morning. That's what time they get woken up for breakfast to get taken over to court. So I mean, just
How come they weren't out on bail?
well,
They're all
because I
local
mean,
people. They were all local community members. How come they weren't given bail?
they were get well, so because of the federal charges, there was a marshal, U.S. Marshal hold place on all of them, so they were never going to be bailed out. But then Johnson County had stuck them with, I mean, the different charges that they had, they set each individual up with like a $5 million bond per charge. So I mean, or bail amount. So I mean, it was just never going to happen. And these are not, again, whatever you think
Another
about,
ground for appeal, I should think, excessive bail requirements.
I would like to think so. Most of them were actually held in solitary confinement for the first 3 months of their incarceration. I mean, some of them lost their ability to speak. They lost
Oh my God.
words. I mean, you could just tell the damage that was being done to them by
And
being kept in these cells alone.
some were held since July, their arrest last
All
July.
of the people who've been arrested, other than maybe the last two or three who were arrested for just being accused of random things like leaving a signal chat or deleting someone from a signal chat. Not even, they didn't even do anything with any messages. They didn't touch any evidence. Literally just booting someone out of a signal chat has got these people. Yes, we have Dario Sanchez has his next court date is set for April 20th. And I will say that and that's in Johnson County. They changed things so quickly. We've noticed that several of the more sort of peripheral defendants, a lot of their upcoming court dates and things have been changed or canceled without explanation. So we're still watching, and I would tell anyone who is following any of these cases, all of this information is kept very up to date on the prairielanddefendants.com website. So that's probably the best place, as well as the various social accounts that we have. Those are all listed on the website as well. So I would say,
Okay. I feel we should have mentioned the names of the what I've dubbed the Prairie Land Nine. And let me read off the list and ask you why, in fact, this group of people were all tried together. Benjamin Song is one is the first. He's the one who allegedly had the rifle and might have fired the bullet. That I thought grazed the officer, but it might
yes,
have.
actually, two officers did say on body camera that night. One of them said so and so was shot, and the other officer said He was grazed, and then
Okay.
another officer said, his direct quote was, "It grazed you, bud." We did find out that he wasn't actually shot through as they claimed, but what happened is that suppressive fire was shot at pavement to stop Thomas Gross from shooting two unarmed protesters in the back. And so that officer was hit by a ricochet, which went into his vest. It did not shoot him through the
It,
neck.
you, you're implying it was a police bullet that grazed him.
Actually, I don't think anyone knows whose bullet grazed him because it sounds like there were only a total of 8 bullets fired. Whereas, of course, in the beginning, they claimed that there were multiple people and they were shooting up the facility, and that is so far from what actually happened.
Okay. So we have the defendants are Benjamin Song, Zachary Evets, Autumn Hill, Megan Morris, Inez Soto, Elizabeth Soto, Savannah Batten, Marciela Rueda, and Daniel Sanchez Estrada. So
Right.
explain why they were tried together, please.
I wish I could.
Okay.
My honest observation of it is that they were tried together because, had any single defendant been tried on their own, none of them would have been convicted. They were put together because the massive amounts of extraneous evidence that the government collected and the hours of video. And of course, during the trial, they played the same videos over and over and over again to try and to make it look like the fireworks show was more than what it was. They said that the facility was damaged by fireworks and fireworks were shot at the facility, but body cam footage also completely debunked those claims. And many officers had to say on the stand, "No, there was no damage done. No, the fireworks, as far as we could tell, I mean, they were shot up into the air 50 yards away, even from the fence line of the facility." So all of the claims that they were shot at the facility and with the intention of damaging the facility were clearly lies. All defendants had their own attorneys.
And did they try to seek to separate their trials from each other?
Not as far as I know. I
I
believe
see.
that there were reasons why. I think that's what should have happened, but also I think that there were reasons why they did not opt to do that I don't fully understand yet.
Well, I could see why the government would want it. Not only do you have a large number of defendants together that they can smear, but it's more efficient for them to throw more people in jail for the cost of one trial, I guess. How can the public, Amber, how can the public support the legal defense of the defendants at this point going forward?
Well, we do have a GiveSendGo account, which is I believe it's under the name Support the Prairieland Defendants. You can also find that. You can be linked to that through our website, prairielanddefendants.com. The best thing that people can do right now is engage. We are having so many individuals and organizations reach out to us now that, we could have used the all if we had had this support 6 months ago. And granted, I understand that it was not known back then what the truth of what happened was, and so people were afraid to engage and people were afraid to support. We're happy to have everyone on board now. Please engage, please share any stories you find, please make sure that tell someone in your life, tell 10 people in your life about what happened to the Prairieland defendants, and make sure that they understand this could have been any of us. I am a school mom. I do school board. I yell at my school board. I, go to county commissioner meetings. These are the things that I do. You know what? They've been calling me Antifa for years, and it's like it's always been a joke. And now I realize it's all of us. Anyone who's doing anything to resist this administration, to push back against the way that ICE is terrorizing our communities, even the most mundane things. I mean, imagine if you wear dark clothes, or even if you don't wear dark clothes, the government will tell people that you did anyway, and then all of a sudden you're a member of Antifa, you're a member of a terror cell. If you shoot off fireworks on the 4th of July in a field, you are a terrorist. Where are all of the Second Amendment people at while we're sitting here convicting people because we don't think that they should have carried a gun to a protest? And so that means that they might have done something. Well, since when are we believing the federal government and what they say is the truth instead of, investigating yourself? Read through the court notes. That's the best thing you can do to help. Have a good understanding of what happened. We had volunteer note takers through the entire trial So although transcripts won't be out until several months down the road where everyone will have forgotten and moved on with their lives, please go now and familiarize yourself with what happened during this trial and help us fight back.
You're saying the transcripts are going to be delayed by months? I thought those were instantaneous.
No,
Go ahead.
there's a process whereby they will have to go through and do, I guess, a reconciliation of sorts and make sure that everyone agrees that the transcript is accurate and it has whatever edits it needs. I'm told that this process could take months before exhibits or transcripts of anything are available.
Meanwhile, they're held in custody. When is the sentencing hearings scheduled?
Sentencing is right now scheduled for June 18th back at the federal courthouse in Fort Worth. Again, things change so rapidly throughout, so I don't know how certain that is, but as of right now, yes, June 18th is when these folks will be sentenced.
Okay. Last question, Amber. Both Pam Bondi, Attorney General, and Kash Patel, FBI Director, are crowing about this verdict, and commentators are noting this is the first of the Trump administration's many attempts to criminalize political dissent. How do you see these cases politically? Do you think they'll serve as a precedent? And what comes next in your mind?
Well, I see these cases politically and legally as, you know, if you're plugged in, especially in Tarrant County, to local politics, this is just a continuation of what we've been seeing as this, you know, far right takeover of Tarrant County has happened, and that is that we're now going back, you know, decades and finding these obscure laws and, you know, this new group of far right, you know, attorneys and legal experts are, you know, reading through these laws and they're misinterpreting them pretty grotesquely, I would say. And you know, and then we don't want to get involved in sort of messy resistance cases. And so that's what allows things like this to happen. And again, we have to understand, you know, if you get called in for jury duty, if you know, get arrested at a protest and the cops ask you to sign a sheet lying about what, you know, this other person did, or they're going to put you in jail for the rest of your life, this is exactly what they want. They want people afraid. They want people to question, you know, should I even go to a protest? Should I wear this color of clothing? Do I need to be careful and you know, not have these reading materials in my home because someone's going to think I'm a member of Antifa? And you know what? Not a single one of us has the luxury of just sitting back while, you know, Bondi and Kash Patel are, you know, celebrating, because this isn't just, you know, you look at these people and you know, you might think they're weird and this is not, you know, your circle, and this isn't the kind of, you know, these people are out in the streets doing mutual aid, taking care of people that most of these folks won't even look in the eye. And you just let them be convicted of the most egregious, you know, trumped up charges possible for things that you probably do yourself. You know, anyone in Texas, you know, our politicians here have, you know, caches of guns that make these look like toys, and some of them were toys, I forgot to add. So just understand, this is going to impact us all. This is
Yeah.
not They're not just going to do this to people that you look at and say, oh, that's Antifa. They're not just going to do this to people in black clothes. They're going to do it to anyone who is doing any sort of community organizing right now, trying to push back against ICE terror, anyone who is resisting the Trump administration, they will do the same thing to you.
That was Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke speaking to Amber Lowry about the Prairieland 9 show trial. The Prairieland Defendant's website has much more about the case, including the individual defendants, court filings and records, media coverage, and ways to get involved. Their website is prairielanddefendants.com.
Desde Laredo a San Antonio, yo he venido a casarme con mi chencha. He podido por ser mojado, pues para todo me exigen la licencia.
por la noche fui a dar al bote, porque no traía ni luces ni licencia. Al fin de todo salí del bote con muchas ganas de ver a mi chencha. Paseando con un gabacho, el mero jefe que arregla la licencia.
That was El Flaco Jiménez, Un Mexicano Sin Licencia. Leonardo Flaco Jiménez, born in San Antonio, Texas in 1939, was a virtuoso accordionist and master of the Tex-Mex, Tejano, and Conjunto sounds of South Texas and North Mexico. Flaco passed away on July 31st, 2025, after a long illness. Adios, Flaco. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Polina Vasiliev. Throughout California, teachers have been going on strike for living wages and health care. This week, 30,000 members of United Teachers Los Angeles, UTLA, and 30,000 members of Service Employees International Union, SEIU, who work in the schools, will go out on strike. At a statewide rally for single-payer healthcare in Sacramento on March 20th, Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer spoke with UTLA teacher Brian Calderon Tabatabai about the strikes.
Yes, my name's Brian Calderon Tabatabai, member of San Gabriel Valley Progressives, former mayor of the city of West Covina, and a proud member of California Teachers Association.
And there have been strikes all over the state of teachers, San Francisco, Richmond, many places, and one of the issues has been health care. Teachers don't have health care, their kids, their dependents. What does this have to do with single payer? Why is single payer related to that whole issue?
Well, every year when we go into negotiation for our contract, that's the number one issue that they try to cut. We spend the entire year fighting to maintain our benefits. And by the time we agree to have no cuts, then we can no longer negotiate any other piece. No smaller class size, no raises. And so every negotiation is a healthcare negotiation. And so CalCare doesn't just benefit those that are uninsured, it benefits every union member, every laborer, because once you can take healthcare off the bargaining table, then you can actually bargain for the things that make your life better.
And the teachers and service workers, SEIU 99, UTLA, are talking about a strike date. They have a strike date.
Yes.
And talk about why healthcare is an issue at this point in their struggle.
Well, you know, every year, like I said, the school districts are trying to make us pay more of our income into the health care. So we take pay cuts every year because what we bring home is less than the year before. Inflation continues to rise, and so it becomes the number one issue. They want to cut it from our retirement benefits. And again, if you cannot afford your health care, you can't afford to live. And so CalCare will allow us to take that off the negotiation table, so then we can negotiate the things that make it better for students, smaller class sizes, and keeps teachers in the profession.
And you spoke at the rally about students who get injured. You're a coach, and having to make a decision about where they're going to go to take care of their injuries. What does that feel like as a coach to deal with that situation?
That is the most horrific experience, you know, because you can hear the suffering of a child, and you understand that it doesn't have to be that way. But to know that if I call 911, I might create a situation where this family is going to be unhoused, that this family isn't going to be able to make it the next day. And so then I'm forced to have this child suffer because I know that me calling 911 is going to put this family into medical debt that they may never get out of. And so to be forced to do that, as someone who's a caregiver of this child, to prolong their suffering, it's just the most horrific thing. And I just cannot believe in the wealthiest state in the nation that is the reality.
And Gavin Newsom previously said he was for single payer. The Democratic politicians here who are supported by CTA and CFT supported them. What happened?
What happened is the insurance companies, they also donate big money. And at the end of the day, the Democratic Party protects a small number of moderate Democrats who every time this issue comes up will either kill it in committee, kill it before it can get a vote on the floor, or put in poison pills that will ensure that Governor Newsom or any governor that comes after will veto the bill. And that's the reality. And the Democratic Party knows this. They protect these moderate Democrats. So that way they don't have to go against the insurance companies. They can play as if, no, we are for single payer. But in reality, they protect those Democratic legislators who've killed it every single year.
And today we're in a war with Iran. Israel is supporting that with U.S. bombs, U.S. weapons. They're bombing Iran. They're bombing Lebanon. The genocide continues. It seems like there's unlimited money, yeah, trillions of dollars for these wars. What does that say about political situation in the United States?
Yeah, like Tupac said, we always have money for bombs, but can't feed the poor. And that's the reality, you know. Bombs are profitable, and keeping people safe and caring for people is not. And the reality is, our current political situation is profit over people, and war is profitable, and healthcare, universal healthcare, in their eyes is not. And the reality is, if you have a healthy country, healthy community, everyone prospers. But I think the elite would rather keep us down, keep us poor, keep us stuck to our jobs that do give us insurance and not give us the freedom to really live the kind of lives that we deserve.
Well, is that an issue in your strike? Because it seems like people are fed up and angry with these wars. In fact, Trump promised he was going to be the peace president. And the Democrats are probably going to be asked to vote for $50 billion, $100 billion more. Is that an issue in your strike? Why are we spending money on war when we can't even take care of the kids and the teachers?
Oh, no, yeah. That's a major issue, you know, and every Democrat that voted against the war resolution, any Democrat that votes for this war, my congressman is Gil Cisneros, and he is a multimillionaire, and he's invested in Raytheon. And I am watching him closely because I understand if he votes for this $50 billion, he's also voting for money in his pocket. A lot of school districts, the way they're able to keep their teachers, like LAUSD, is because they'll have lifetime benefits for the union members. And that's fantastic, but it also doesn't give the freedom of a teacher who now has to, because living in LA is so unaffordable. So we have teachers that are commuting 90 minutes, 2 hours, 3 hours a day on the road, but they can't leave. They can't move to a school district closer to their home because they know that that school district won't provide the lifetime benefits. And so when I retire, well, I can't retire because I need that health care. And that's something, again, I think why CalCare, universal health care, should be the number one issue for every labor union, every worker, because without it, we don't have freedom to move job to job, to move city to city. We are stuck, and they keep us stuck.
That was UTLA teacher Brian Calderon Tabatabai, talking about the strikes taking place throughout California schools. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Thomas O'Rourke and Steve Zeltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Polina Vasiliev. Thanks for listening.